Burn before listening. Welcome back to another episode of Sterling Municipal Library's podcast, All Booked, where we talk to you about books we'd like to recommend.
And I begged Chasley and Donald to join me in reviewing This Is How You Lose the Time War. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I picked this book up was Donald described it as one of the most romantic books that he had ever read. And I read the book, and the characters never kissed. It kind of reminded me a little bit of how my mom would talk about this movie that she really, really liked and how romantic it was. And these two characters would just stare at each other very intensely throughout the entire film. So that's about the energy that this one gives, but I loved it, so I don't regret reading it.
Like Bollywood romance drama where they just like stare into each other's eyes and maybe at some point like will hold a thing that the other person held.
It's like
I'm with them.
Although this is very intense letter writing.
Yes, that's how it is. This maybe could win an award for most intense letter writing.
Yes.
Okay, now I'll turn over the floor.
This is how you lose the podcast.
Oh, no.
I always look up like awards and reviews and stuff. This one won both the Hugo and Nebula Awards for Best Novella, as well as like a host of other awards that I'd never heard of. I thought that was pretty cool.
And it is pretty exciting because it's a novella, but it's a novella written by two different people.
Yes!
And it's written by two people because there are two protagonists.
Yes. And one writes one and the other one writes the other.
Which is such an interesting idea.
It is so good. They did write like a general outline beforehand, but then they said, and this is a quote, "The reactions of each character were developed with a genuine element of surprise on receiving each letter, and the scenes accompanying the letters were written using that emotional response."
Oh, that's so cool.
That is so fun. It feels almost like an RPG, like you're sitting there waiting and then the machine spits out your response and you're like, oh no, what's happening? That's so exciting. So tell us a little bit about the characters, the setting. What is a time war?
Settings, plural.
Yeah. Yes, settings. Yes, yes. Yeah, get into it.
Okay, so there is a war going on throughout all of time and space.
Yeah.
There are these agencies in the far-flung future called the Agency and the Garden, and they represent like two different sides of, in my brain, two different sides of like a spectrum, right? From their names alone, you can almost kind of tell. Mm-hmm. The Garden is very fantasy, very fanciful. The way they operate it in like, I imagine what whimsy would look like if you could see it on a painting.
It almost describes it as like this slow-growing, organic, like holistic organization.
Very, very
natural. It is a collective, but it's very nature-themed.
Yes. Yeah. And then the Agency is on the opposite side of that. It's very mechanical, very techno-driven. The protagonist who comes from this agency has all these like mechanical, I call them embellishments, because like she could like, this is gonna be gross, take off her skin and like she has like she could get wings in the back and things like that. And the way she described her like bodily processes would be like, if a machine discovered they had a human body, how would that machine like talk about their body?
Yeah, she could turn off the sensation of hunger because that would get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. And then these two people these agents from,
and what are their names?
Red and Blue.
Blue is from Garden, Red is from the Agency.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes.
And you're having a war throughout time.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
The book spent less time on the warfare as opposed to like it did their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine though that each like the Agency and the Garden, they have their own ends. They want to secure the future for themselves. And so they send agents throughout the past and throughout time to make sure that certain timelines work out in their favor.
Mm-hmm. And it talks a lot about the different timelines being separate strands that you're braiding together to get specific outcomes. So one hub that seems to get focused on a lot is the city of Atlantis, and how that one seems to exist in all timelines, regardless of which one you're looking at, but it gets destroyed in every single one of them as well. Mm-hmm. So you have like, I guess, a loci, where everything kind of tends to converge, and then it separates out into separate strands again.
A canon event.
Mm-hmm. A canon event. Thank you.
As Marvel says.
It's one of those stories that if you are a time travel fan, if you love reading and watching time travel stuff, will sort of frustrate you a little bit because it is vague enough to be frustrating, but gives like just enough like information that you're like, oh, I'm going to need another 500 pages
of kind
this.
Where they're like, this is definitely time travel, but we're not going to talk about that.
Yes, which is the entire reason I picked up the book, of course.
Which is probably why I liked it more, because I usually hate timey-wimey stuff.
Oh my God, I love it. it. I could live for it. This is also not the book to start with no information, because I pick up anything that says, has anything to do with time travel, and honestly don't usually read even like the inside blurb. This is not the book that you want to do that with. More is better, I think, when you're going more information to start with.
Yeah.
Will help you get into it. It's not heavy on the detail where that's concerned.
You just kind of dropped into the
story. Yes. Okay. And you're like, who's doing what now?
Yeah, I fully agree with that, because I was telling them earlier, I completely read the book, like, I'm going to say wrong the first time. But it wasn't wrong. It's just that I went into it with this mindset. It's going to be a sci-fi fantasy, like, adventure story, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be these two spies duking it out to, like, to see who wins the time war in the end. And I got like a little bit of that, but I was mostly just kind of thrown by all the, like, the flowery language. And I didn't really, like, the romance of it all flew over my head that first time. So I read it again the second time, and I was just like, oh no, this is like fully a romance.
This is a romance.
They're very much in love. They've been in love the whole time.
Donald's problem was he was reading an adventure novel when it was a romance novel.
Although, to be fair, they never kiss.
Yes, exactly.
Doesn't matter. Romance isn't just kissing.
Yeah.
The language, though, was really interesting when I was reading some of the reviewers, which is always really funny because, again, like, people do this for a living. They review stuff, and so sometimes the way that they do it is hilarious. And they're like, the best and worst part of this novel is, like, the flowery language.
Oh,
they're
no.
like, the flowery language got in the way of the entire plot, but the flowery language was the point of the plot, and it was fantastic, and I hated it. And that was one reviewer.
So I ended up underlining a whole bunch of sections of it, and I remember at one point, my son saw me doing it, and he looked at me aghast and was like, is that a library book? And I was like, I would never. This is my personal one. And then he was like, why are you underlining stuff? And I was like, some of these quotes are beautiful.
Oh my God. I'd like.
This is an underlining book.
Yes.
Absolutely. I am so hurt that they said that the flowery language got in the way of it, because listening to it the second time, I was like, I'm here because of what
but
they're saying to each other.
Maybe they were you in the first read.
Yeah. That makes
they
more
were
sense.
Just like, wait, but my adventure novel. It's not adventuring.
Yeah. But then, like, once you let that go and you sit with it, it's just so nice to hear, like, if we will get into that section right now, some of the quote that I wrote down.
Oh, we got quotes.
Yes.
Okay.
The first quote that I wrote down is one that Red sent to Blue, and she was talking about how, I'll just read it. Do you laugh, seafoam? Do you smile, ice, and observe your triumph with angels remove? Sapphire flamed phoenix, risen, do you command me once again to look upon your works and despair? And it was just like, that's one of a quote from the letters they wrote to each other.
Is that a reference?
Probably. This is full of references to all sorts of things. Yeah. Some of them definitely flew over my head, but.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure some of them are made up, assuming it like it's a later point in time that we haven't gotten to yet.
That's very
or a separate strand, yeah. So I'll give you a Blue quote then. It is difficult to find those who, when they are asked, do I have you still, when they end a letter with yours, mean it in any substantive way.
Stuff like that, man. It's just like, oh.
But I think what I really liked about it was they started off like leaving each other like basically diss tracks.
Yes.
Like, they were taunting each other in the beginning, talking about how their side was going to win. And I loved it.
It was awesome. They're both really good at their job. Like, they're the best agents on both of their sides. So it's just like to be thwarted by someone else is intriguing, but also frustrating. Yeah. And so you have that like.
It was the spy thing where they're like, you're the only person I respect.
Yes.
Because you're just as good as I am.
But you also get the sense that both of them are very lonely. And I think that's why they continue this contact with each other. Mm-hmm. So Blue is kind of described in one of the letters as a tumbleweed. So usually garden, you would think that they're fully rooted and they're somewhat connected in some sort of viney way. And she kind of just drifts. Like there was something that happened to her at one point that partially severed her connection to the rest of the whole. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, she has preferred to stay adrift. And I think on some level, she recognizes Red as a kindred spirit because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. At one point, Red travels to a different timeline, different world, where, like, there is no people there, like, the world has died, and she's just standing on this hill watching the sky and, like, listening to the sun, and she can still hear all of the other agents she's connected to, but she turns that off, which is, like, egregious for them to do. She got in a lot of trouble for it. So it's, like, that connection the book used the word deviancy, but I think it's more of, like, wanderlust, that they both kind of, like, found each other.
So I did want to ask, did you guys have very much of a picture of what either Red or Blue looked like? Because there was one point where Blue kind of was described as having like a silver jaw. And I know they have to change their appearance a whole bunch between like whatever operation they're sent on. But
I'm going to say no. But also I'm going to say that I usually skip that part in books anyway. So
boring.
I don't care what you look like. You're a person, sort of.
I think so. Piggybacking off of that one. I wasn't exactly sure how they were jumping from like strand to strand. Blue described it as being embedded into each strand, and like the garden operates over long periods of time, long stretches of time. So I was assuming that it was like a reincarnation sort of situation. They're being seeded, as in like they're being planted in like a person who already exists in that time, grows with that person, and then at some point, like a sleeper agent, like executes their mission. And whereas Red, I see her as more just bouncing from timeline to timeline. It seemed like she had a lot of control over that ability, and like because of her mechanical aspect, I didn't see her meshing very well with any timeline to like to have lived there for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. So the front cover of it is a blue jay and a cardinal that are like kind of like fractal. I feel like maybe that's obviously blue and red. It's symbolic, yes. But also maybe like indicative of them as people. The fractured, non-coherent image where everything is kind of skewed. Because yeah. I feel like when you're writing like a very flowery book about romance, I don't think the outside part matters, because I think the outside part of them from the way you've described is so different that like that can't come into play that much, because if one of them is like a person plant and one of them is a person
robot
machine,
plant.
That makes me feel a little bit better about the fact that that is a male cardinal.
Yes.
Oh, what? How can you tell?
Well, male cardinals
like
are red.
Very strong sexual dimorphism with cardinals. Not the. Is that? I don't even can tell. Is that a blue jay? Some sort of bluish bird.
It looks like a swift.
Oh, okay, cool.
Maybe or a swallow, but I don't know that they come in blue. So
yeah.
Got you.
They probably just made up a bird.
They should consult me.
This is a bird from a different thread of time.
Honestly, that makes me feel better.
Yeah, very different, very different.
Even as they communicate with each other, though, they start calling each other nicknames. So rather than just addressing it as blue or red, and I know you wrote some of them down. Mm-hmm. One of them was where they wrote the, what do you call it? Like the web-based color code?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the numbers and the letters. Yeah.
One time they addressed them as that. There is one time where one of them calls red a cardinal, so like it it is pretty cute, like how they start to come up with bizarre
fun
ways
names
to address each other.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, and then
did you look up the color?
There was this one that I had to look up.
There's a lot of reds, so you should have checked.
I did not check that.
You should have checked the hex code to see what that was.
There was this one I had to look up. It was an insect that they used to make the color carmine. Cochineal, I think it is. Insect. It stuck out to me because it's like blue uses it once to reference red, and red didn't know what it was, so she had to look it up. And she was like, cochineal, I get it now. In like a postscript, and I was like, what is a cochineal?
And you were like, I don't.
I don't know what it is.
Well, and they're leaving each other letters, but they're doing it in really like unconventional formats. Mm-hmm. So, and they keep, I think, addressing like letter etiquette to each other too, which is really funny, because at one point they say, well, technically you should like put it in a seal, which Red takes very literally and puts it inside of an actual seal animal.
I missed that the first time. I did, the whole seal pun went over my head the first time. So when it was happening this time, like she said, she puts it in a seal, right? And so to read the letter, you have to open up the seal. And the first time, in my first read through, I was like, oh, this book is so like edgy. And then I read this time, I was like, oh no, she just didn't get it. the poor thing.
She's like, this is weird, but okay.
Instructions unclear.
But one of the interesting things, and I think that, okay, so she's leaving these letters in these unique ways. They both are. But burn before reading is one of the lines.
That's one of the first ones.
And it's I think it is the very first one, because when she finds something that says burn before reading, I was like, oh, okay, I'm definitely going to finish this book. Like,
yes,
it's such a great line. It's almost iconic before you read the rest of the story. Mm-hmm. Like, I love it.
I have a section on my notes that I kind of wanted to talk about with you guys.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about the yearning.
The yearning.
So this book is a romance, and they are very much like separated by time, space, war. They don't ever actually see each other, like for the first couple of note exchanges, but like you can see their intimacy grow as they like begin to ask questions. They start very playful, taunting, and then they move into more like, no, tell me something true. Tell me something true about you. And it's the first kind of like dare for them to like jump into this unseen like world now. Every time a letter was sent, every time a letter was received, there was just so much emotion and like rapture around it. I was like, dang, like you guys are in it, man. And I was just like, I wanted to talk about that. What were your guys' thoughts?
Oh, yeah. Well, in the level of reverence that they would treat the letters with once they received them, because they had to commit it to memory and then destroy evidence of it.
So
It was pretty moving.
It really was. It's giving me very Regency vibes.
Oh, absolutely.
It is just weirdly like a Regency, yeah. Not in a time period kind of
like, yeah, like all the time periods, the yearning, yeah. The, yes. Oh, I can't see you because that's just not the life we live. that kind of energy, I feel like. And the flowery language also helps, like mm-hmm. the very descriptive and very full of imagery, like mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
It was good. It was good. At one point, I like to just say Regency because at one point they end up, or Blue ends up getting a letter in a world she calls London Next, which is like a London where colonization worked in that world. And so they only had myths of their greatness in London, right? And like the setting is unimportant, but like it's all very Regency because they stuck to those like London or rules to the stories of Regency novels of just like the time period, the world, the wording. There we go. And I was just like, okay, cute. This is a Regency novel. Like Jane Austen would be so proud.
I will say, if you read this book, not to skip the author's bio at the back, because
it
is one of the best. Just a section of it. Amal El-Mohtar, who wrote Blue's part.
Oh, I always wondered who did what.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Wrote The Honey Month, a collection of poetry and prose written to the taste of 28 different kinds of honey. Mm. How perfect is that for Blue? And Max Gladstone, who wrote Red, has been thrown from a horse in Mongolia, wrecked a bicycle in Angkor Wat, and sung in Carnegie Hall. And I was like, what?
This explains so much about the two characters.
It explains so much.
A lot. But I'm also like, you know what? You two could just sit down and write about your lives. I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Could just be a biography.
I don't know how much Amal El-Mohtar has written apart from this. I think maybe a couple other things. I know Max Gladstone
novels.
Has written a lot.
Yes. And I would say that I feel like his are very different.
Yes,
like,
but they've been very well received,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah. Like, but the energy is very different. So I think this is something that is specific to them writing together. Like,
yes.
this feeling and the tone of the novel. I think their separate works are not the same. I looked up her work and I recognize one of the books, but it's not something that's coming to my mind. But she has written some other things as well.
It makes me wish that more, like, really good authors would be like, hey, buddy, let's write an epistolary novel together.
Let's do a little experiment. Because
yeah.
I think seeing writers obviously successful, you don't want to see a failed project, kind of like test themselves and push boundaries and treat writing less as like, okay, I'm just going to write my next novel in my style, and more like, I wonder what I can do if I try really hard with the English language. I wonder if I can make something cool and different. And especially if you have a partner that you enjoy writing with, I'm sure there's like a level of excitement and joy that you just can't get writing by yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, you can be really happy with your work, but it's not the same as working together towards something with another person.
And I think that we've gotten a lot of benefit out of that. Like, Christina Lauren is
yes.
two people, and
mm-hmm.
James S.A. Corey is two people.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows who else?
who else is two people?
Secretly?
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. one.
Three cats
Please
in a trench
email
coat.
Us if you are two people. No, I'm kidding. I want to keep it a secret. Do you have anything else that you would like to share about the book? Anything about scenes that stood out to you, especially exciting things? If you really had like 10 seconds to pitch it to somebody and you were like, please read this book, what would you say? That kind of thing.
10-second pitch. Interesting.
Also, did anyone listen to it?
I did, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
How
and
was that?
That was really interesting because I thought there were two narrators.
Oh, cool.
But I didn't know that the entire time. Like halfway through the book, I looked at my the little icon that you see on your phone, and it's like read by this person and this person. I was like, there's two people here. They sound a lot like each other.
Oh no.
But once I learned there were two people, I could tell the differences. Yeah, I could hear the differences.
Yeah.
And then once you could hear the differences, it changed the story for me because mm-hmm. it's just like I started to equate like Red's voice with Red's anguish, and then like Blue's voice with that was that one period Blue gets is she's in a timeline where she has a husband and is like living a life or whatever because it's for the greater good of the garden or whatever, and she has this dreamy language she's talking about like picking flowers and like tasting honey and things like that. All of that suddenly became coded with this narrator's voice, and so I carried it on throughout the novel, and like that was really cool.
My pitch is that I read it once, I reread it for this podcast, and now I'm gonna have to listen to it on audio because that is very appealing. I'm not at all sad about this.
I love knowing that they kind of went into this blind, because there was one point where I read this in spurts because once I started reading it, I couldn't put it down. But there was one point where I got, so Red gets caught. I feel like that's not too much of a spoiler.
I don't really think this doesn't feel like a book you can spoil because it feels like the point is the book.
No, the point
is the
experience. Mm-hmm. So Red gets caught, and she then gets commissioned by the Commandant with writing a poisonous letter to Blue.
Oh.
And so I had to put the book down and go to work, like right after Blue received that letter, and I was like fretting about it during my entire shift.
I remember you walked up to me that day and was like, "So I'm at work right now, but all I can think about is the book."
So I kind of even wonder what that was like for writing that part. Like, once you get handed that and be like, okay, this is your poison. Do you take it or no?
Oh, no. Like,
Oh my gosh.
I love that part. So on my notes, I have a section about the final act, but I don't know if you guys wanted to talk about it or not. That happens in the final act. And it was one of the funniest scenes in the book for me because the note is written in like a plant. You can read plants in a special way, whatever. And the poison was so obvious to Blue. She was just like, I'm almost offended that like I think her words were like, she felt as though her defeat should have come at more skilled hands. Something like that. Yeah. And so like she could tell it's a trap. She knows it's bad. But she does it anyway because she knows it's from Red. And it's very much just like, oh my God, girl, what's going on? What are you doing?
And this is right after one of them was watching part of Romeo and Juliet, too.
Yes. I think it was Red or Blue. Oh, it was Blue. Blue's talking to Red. Blue's talking about how she loves going to different timelines and watching Romeo and Juliet in every timeline. Because in some timelines, it's a tragedy. And others, it's a comedy. And she loves that she never knows which one it's going to be which.
I do want to say it's sort of a spoiler, but not really, that this does end hopefully. Like, it is not a Romeo and Juliet ending.
Yes. Don't
go into it thinking that, because that would be sad.
Oh, yeah.
Because I just read that and then had to go to work. I was like, oh my gosh,
I don't know what's going to happen. There's no way this could end well. So, yeah, it seems like the perfect book if you like the more experiential novel.
I mean, if you liked Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but you want to elevate it, I feel like that would be a good way to.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but time travel.
Yeah, time travel with flowery language.
Yeah. Did you want Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but set in the Regency era, but not set in the Regency era, but set in all the eras?
Yes.
This is for you.
Yes, I would read 20 of those.
Yeah. Okay. Does anyone else want to add anything?
I want to say burn before reading again, just because I'm so, just, I cannot.
We should put that
words before,
in the beginning of the podcast, burn before listening.
Burn before listening.
There you go.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me. I had to talk about this book. And stay tuned next week for more fantastic book recommendations.
Bye.